thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
This is the Fighter Pilot Podcast, episode 56. This week, retired United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Scott joins us to discuss the British-designed Cold War-era jump jet that went on to become a favorite among airshow attendees and Marine pilots alike.
Of all the airplanes I flew, I'd like to say the Harrier was still the most fun, just stick and rudder flying. Loved it. Great plane.
Strap in for the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Now, here are your hosts, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilots Vincent Aiello and Brian Sinclair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. This is episode 56, and when you hear that song from our musician Jaime Lopez, you know we're talking powered lift, and that is the case today with our interview on the AV-8 Harrier coming up. But first, let's introduce our co-host. How's it going there, Sunshine?
Hey, Jello. It's going well, man. Just spent a little time in the desert last week, and now I'm back in San Diego. How about you?
Oh, doing well. Just keeping on. Everything's trucking along here. Let's see. Last time we checked in with you, you said your back was giving you fits. How's that working out?
Oh, yeah. I'm still walking around like I'm 70. But hopefully be as optimistic as the prognosis, and I'll be better shortly. Thanks.
Okay.
How about you, Jello?
Oh, everything's good, man. Just busy as always. Got a lot going on with the show. Got a kid off at college now, and the other two are back at school. So life is trucking along, and I can't believe it's almost fall. In fact, here we are in September. You and I are recording this right before, but this episode will air right after Tailhook. And last year, the two of us were up there and provided an update on all the goings on, but you're not going to be able to make it this year, huh?
Nah, the day job calls, if you will. But how about you, Jell? Are you going to be heading up there with anybody?
In fact, yes. We've got our two other leadership players in the podcast sphere here. Let's see, Goat and Owl is what we call them, but yeah. Rob Grady and Scott Morris, a couple guys that are strategic thinkers, will be up there. In fact, we're considering doing maybe a quick Facebook Live or something while we're there. So I guess by the time people hear this, they'll know what we ended up doing. But yep, Tailhook is always a fun time to see everybody, and we'll have to maybe plant the flag a little better next year. But speaking of that, the other thing in September is the Miramar Air Show. I still haven't decided if I'm going to that or not, but what's your schedule like? That's always at the end of September.
Right, yeah. I think it starts the 27th, right, of September. So, unfortunately, once again, I'll be duty calls. So I think I'll be in Pax River for that last half of the week. Yeah, so unfortunately, okay. I'll miss it again. But it is quite an epic air show, wouldn't you say, Jello?
Oh, yeah. It's always a great show. And like I said, I just don't know. Last year, we put a lot of effort into it. This year, we're a bigger show already. So maybe we should just go and let people know where we'll be hanging out and see what happens. I just haven't decided yet. But
gotcha.
It's a good show. It's our hometown show. And the Red Arrows are going to be there. So we probably need to make the effort.
Indeed.
Anyway, let's see. A couple announcements. More is better, at least some people think. And certainly, as the case is with the podcast, now that the kids are back in school, we're going to return to our previous format of three shows per month. And at least for the rest of this year, we'll go with the 2nd, 12th, and 22nd. Now, this episode is airing on Monday the 9th, which we were doing that every other Monday thing for a while. So I thought, Sunshine, what we'll do is replay the question and answer live session we did at your house with Turkey.
Oh, with Turkey. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we got the audio doctored up as good as we can, and we'll replay that on the 12th just to reset the schedule, and then we'll pick back up with episode 57th on the 22nd.
Okay.
And then we'll go back to that 3-a-month format after that. Let's see. We also wrote a couple articles recently. We have some exclusive articles now that we offer our Patreon flight leads and above.
Yeah.
Last month, we did one on warhead fuses and employment considerations. And this month, we're going to do it on Russian and Chinese aircraft nomenclature. So what's in a name? Like Juliet asked you know, Romeo.
Nice. That'll be a good read.
Yeah, it should be. I guess you didn't ask him. I think she was asking it anecdotally. But anyway, yeah, I used that little intro for the article. So that should be good. And then every month after that, we'll have another kind of exclusive inside deeper level article on something having to do with military aircraft.
Okay.
We also did a recent behind the scenes on water survival. People seem to enjoy that. Get a look at what you have to go through to survive in the event of a mishap in the water. Sunshine, I know you've done that a few times in your career.
Oh, I have, dude. I'll tell you what. I used to dread it, and then finally I realized that the biggest enemy I have in the water is myself. You know what I'm saying about the whole fear factor thing?
Ah, yeah. Well, you got to just keep your wits about you, right?
Yeah, keeping your wits about you, keeping your breathing under control, and the rest of it kind of comes naturally, believe it or not.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of diabolical. You know, they strap you into these contraptions, flip you upside down, put you underwater.
Goggled, sometimes, yes. Blacked out goggles.
Blacked out goggles, you bet. So if you're interested in that, head over to our YouTube channel and take a look for Behind the Scenes. I believe it was number 18.
Sounds right.
Okay. Well, Sunshine, you know how it is. Every episode, we get a little feedback on the previous episode. So, yep.
Which we appreciate.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So, listener Dwayne Alderman told us that his father was an Air Force FAC-A during Vietnam and flew the O-2, which was a converted Cessna 337 Skymaster.
Nice.
And they also, in Vietnam, used the O-1 Bird Dogs and the OV-10 Broncos. But I guess they used something different in the Korean conflict, huh?
Yeah, Angelo, I think the L-5, right, was used in the Korean conflict.
Yep, that's right. I think Chili mentioned that during our interview. And then also our old buddy, Mike Torrealday, T-Day, our F-16 guest, he wrote back because I sent him a question. Hey, what about the single seat F-16 guys? And he says that it used to be just the OV-10, I should say, Bronco, mm-hmm. and OA-10 Thunderbolt.
Okay.
But then after Desert Storm, there was an Aviano Italy air wing that used Block 40s, and they started doing some of that FAC-A stuff in the Balkan conflict, and then later they turned that into some procedures out at the RAG, or RTU, I think they call it.
Yes.
At Luke Air Force Base, and then so they started doing that in Block 40s, and the biggest thing he told me that I thought was interesting, Sunshine, is the single seat guys were doing FAC-A missions, some of them, not too much anymore in the F-16, but at the time they were still doing all the other missions that they do, and I just find that tough to believe, because that's a difficult thing to do.
That is a daunting thing, man. You got to be the jack of all trades, maybe master of none, right?
Yeah, well, that was certainly the case I felt in the F-18. But
me too.
Yeah, maybe these guys do it better. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. All right, bud, how about some listener questions? I can start with one for you from Alex from the UK. Sound good?
Yes, sir.
All right. Being on a carrier, Alex asks, for a longer time, do pilots actually connect with other teams, and I'll just insert the word divisions of the ship, in their free time, or do they mostly stick to themselves?
Well, Alex, thank you very much for the question. I'd say, Jello, that we predominantly stuck within the air wing. So all the squadrons would play well together, both with the ground pounders, the non-flying officers, as well as the pilots. And we had, you know, especially on no-fly days, do you remember doing things like feats of strength?
Oh, yeah. We had all kinds of shenanigans. But
So, yeah, stupid human tricks, feats of strength. So there would be competitions to see, hey, who can chug 32 ounces of milk the fastest, or how many M&Ms can you stick in your face, you know, who can stick the most, I should say, and all that good stuff. That goodness was traditionally with amongst the air wing itself. But then we also had things like, remember the officer deck training, the OOD training?
Yeah.
Where the ship would kind of try to, I don't want to say force, but would help to facilitate, how about that?
Mm-hmm.
A more of a mingling between the ship's company and the air wing by sending the air wing personnel at a certain rank, if you will, up into the bridge. And they would go through an abbreviated syllabus of learning how to operate or navigate, really, the aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And then also chapel. Chapel's a time where I would interact with not only the carrier air wing, right, the CVW, but also the ship's company there. I also had a standalone Bible study. So there are opportunities. Oh, Wardroom 3. How about that, Jello? Did you hang out with many guys other than air wing bubbas down in the Wardroom 3?
Yeah, once in a while. I mean, I don't know. I guess to Alex's point, it's not like we shun each other or avoid each other.
No.
But you tend to stick with, you know, your own cliques. I'm sure it's the same way. Anyone who's been to a school, you know, you've got your friend. If you're on a team, you stick with your team, and you say hi to other folks. But yeah, for the most part, I would add, though, Sunshine, did you ever get to go down and do a tour of the weapons magazines?
Yes, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, so there's another time you get a chance to see all those guys. But yeah, we do interact. And of course, if you see each other on Liberty, you say hello, but that's pretty much it.
I agree.
All right, how about we take a phone call next?
Hello, Jello and Sunshine. This is Hakeem Dixon from sunny South Florida. My question is, Jello, you mentioned that you were stationed in Japan at one point, right? So my question is, like, Did you ever have, like, any negative, say, experiences with the people of Japan? Has anybody ever, like, given you flack or anything like that? And then, secondly, how did you feel, like, when, during your first, like, couple of years? Like, did you ever feel like, what did I get myself into, or did you ever regret it? Something like that. And my last question is, like, I know you guys don't want to broach politics or anything like that, but how do you feel about the threat posed by North Korea? Like, I do know, like, California is a probable target area, so, like, how do you feel about them? Do you think we should be scared of them or whatnot? Thanks, guys, for the content, and hope to see what you got coming next, and many thanks to the gods.
All right, Hakeem, thank you very much from South Florida. Sounds like they did okay from Dorian recently, hopefully. No, I never had any trouble with anyone while I was in Japan. I was only there for 1 year. I was supposed to stay longer, but I had a health issue that forced me to move on. And I remember at the time, something had happened in Okinawa with some Marines and some locals.
Yeah.
And there were some very peaceable and peaceful protests outside our base, but I never interacted with anyone from that. And so, no, I never had any trouble. I never asked myself, what did I get myself into? I know, and maybe you do too, Sunshine, people who go back to Japan tour after tour if they can because they just love it.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I really liked that it was such a different culture. It was very different from the US and in a lot of ways, in good ways. You know, they're very much based on pride and shame, which are kind of opposite sides of the coin, if you will. But also, they're not very litigious. So our kids really loved their parks and the different contraptions that they had because, you know, there was different things they could crawl on and play on, and they didn't worry too much about kids getting hurt. And if they did, that was just part of being a kid. They didn't worry about getting sued, I guess. And as far as being concerned about threats from North Korea, no, I don't live in fear of pretty much anything. Do they have things that can reach out and touch us both in Japan and here on the West Coast? I guess, theoretically, but what good does it do myself to live in fear? So, no, I don't worry about that. Sunshine, you didn't do any tours in Japan, I don't think, correct?
No, I did no tours in Japan. Just stopped there with a carrier for port calls. That was it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Are you quaking at night by the North Korea threat?
No, but I mean, if you look at it from a more objective perspective, I guess you could say you got capabilities and intent, right, for North Korea. So from the capability side, I mean, they do have active and increasingly sophisticated nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. I mean, as evidenced back in 2017, I think it was, they had their first successful intercontinental ballistic missile launch, the Hwasong 15. And it's got, our analysts say it's got an estimated range of 8,000 miles, so it can reach anywhere in the continental U.S., yeah. Now, the actual test was only 590 miles, and I guess it dropped down in some kind of exclusive economic zone in Japan or something. But still, point being is they've demonstrated the capability. They've also, I think later that year in September, they had some they called thermonuclear weapons testing. So the capabilities are there. And when it comes to the intent, though, think about April now of 2018, so a year later from the earlier example, and Kim Jong-un halted testing on weapons, on those types of weapons. And he had that summit with the South Korean leaders. Or leadership. So that was a good, you know, example of extending the olive branch, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then June, just a little bit later there, he also met Kim Jong-un, that is, met with Donald Trump in Singapore. So you had that going for us, if you will. But then, unfortunately, in February of this past year, they had that summit in Hanoi, Vietnam, and kind of stalled out the talks. And unfortunately, as of late, as of August, I think the testing for the short-range ballistic missiles is back in full swing. So, Jello, I totally get what you say. Can't live in fear, but I would say the capabilities and potentially the intentions are there.
Yeah, I just have to think if they were foolish enough to do anything, the international reaction would be pretty damning.
Yes.
And I don't think they'd come out too well on the other side of that. But yep, that's a good nuanced addition. Thank you very much. All right, let's move on to Fernando Martinez. Sunshine, this one's right up your alley. What happens if an aircraft falls into the water, he says? Does it sink immediately or can it stay afloat for some time?
Well, I've seen both. So I think, Fernando, thank you very much for the question. I think you're kind of touching on Archimedes' principle, right? Which that whole, was that buoyant force thing kind of defined. It's very fundamental to fluid dynamics. And it basically says that if the weight of the water displaced is greater than the object weight, then the object will float, right? So if planes, when they hit the water, they usually break apart. When they break apart, water fills in the vacuums, the voids and all that, and down they go. But if they happen to stay together, there have been some examples, right, Jello, of things floating. Like think of Captain, or I should just say Sully's A320, right, in the Hudson River. That floated for a while.
That's right. Yeah, it did. In fact, they were able to put a barge on it and drag it over to the side. And I think they pulled it out. I forget what happened after that. But yeah, you've heard, at least I have anecdotally, of people who eject and they are sometimes near their aircraft or if they ditch or whatever. And it floats for a time, I suppose, until the water fills in all those voids. And then, like you said, down they go. So yeah, it's a little bit of both.
I think, a little bit of Fernando's point. And then I ended up chatting with chief in the back of the depot with me, and he was actually aboard that COD that launched out of Japan when it had the issue and it crashed into the water just to the starboard side or the right side of the aircraft carrier. So, and that thing did not float very long at all. And unfortunately, they did lose some air crew. So sometimes they float, sometimes they sink, and usually it's based on fuselage damage.
Okay.
Cool. All right, should we move on to, how about another question, Jello?
Go for it.
This one's from Terry in Singapore, and he asks, what are mental exercises fighter pilots engage in so that they can hold their nerve during an intense moment, like a dogfight?
Well, that's an interesting question, Terry. Thanks for that. I wouldn't say I did any mental exercises just for the sake of exercise, like math equations or puzzles or anything. But what I would do is if there was a particular maneuver I was struggling with, whether it was a deck transition, i.e. leveling off right before you hit the artificial deck, which would be the ground in real life, or if there was something else I was not doing well, I would sit and chair fly it. So I'd close my eyes. And I think we talked about this on the Blue Angel interview that you did with Little G some time back. Yeah. So they'll close their eyes and go through their maneuvers. I would do the same thing. I would imagine what I was doing with the stick throttle and rudders, and just try to imagine when I see this, I'm going to do this, and this is what I expect the result to do. So for me, it was visualization. Do you ever have any mental exercises, Sunshine?
Yeah, it was predominantly chair flying, just like you said. Case in point would be Air Force Test Pilot School, where they say, hey, welcome to Test Pilot School. Here's the gouge on this next plane. You're going to fly it in a day and a half. You're going to basically read the gouge, take a quiz, go fly the jet, and then write a report on it. So that required a lot. I was very uncomfortable pretty much for all the evolutions, and my day would usually start up by reading, or my evolution would start up by reading the text and then doing, just like you said, Jello, chair flying.
Gotcha. All right. I think we have time for one more question, then we'll get on to the interview.
Okay. You want to do a phone call?
Sure.
Hey, guys. This is Dan from the U.S., born and raised in Maryland, but currently living in the Czech Republic. I have a question regarding speed brakes, which is that on all kinds of aircraft, you can find speed brakes in all kinds of positions on the aircraft. So on the bottom, on the sides, top and bottom, just top. And it seems to me that the variation where speed brakes are put means that they can be put almost anywhere and it's not really thought about. So is that true? Is it really important for every aircraft where the speed brake is put? Or is it kind of slapped on anywhere and it just does the trick by helping ditch speed? Anyway, just wanted to ask that, and thanks very much. Keep up the great work.
All right, Sunshine, this sounds like your ballpark again. What do you think?
Well, thank you, Jello. So, and Dan, thank you from, I guess, formerly a Marylander, now from the Czech. So when you talk about speed, or some people call them air brakes, right? Let's look a little bit at the history, if you don't mind. So back in 36, the German glider designs actually had dive brakes, which were these blades that would pop out of the upper lower portions of the wings. The idea caught on. They said, hey, why don't we use flaps? They started using flaps in the 30s and 40s, and then eventually the manufacturing design goal, if you will, was really to go supersonic. Well, it turns out supersonic aircraft have a tough time traditionally back then with speed brakes on the wings, so they transitioned to the fuselage, and that allowed for basically more robust speed brakes, plus also better wing control. So nowadays, though, technology is a lot better, obviously, and they take into account a lot of things. Like we always say on the show, Jello, it's a series of compromises, right? So they're going to look, they're going to look at the size, they're going to look at surface area, location, and the amount of drag produced by each shape, and you get what you see, which is on the F-15, the Legacy Hornet, and the SU-27. They've got basically that after that on the back speed brake, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you look at from the 50s, the Royal Navy Buccaneer, this was kind of cool. It actually had a split tail cone, so the tail cone would separate into two little pieces, and that would act as the speed brake. Now on the T-45, you know, you got the speed brakes on the sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
And aft, the empennage area. And then think...
Yeah, A4 was the same way.
Yeah, great call. And then also, sometimes they use the drag chute, right? Like the shuttle, for example, has the drag chute. Plus, it also has its rudder turns into basically a speed brake, right? It splits into two directions, if you will.
Whoa.
So it's kind of neat.
Okay.
And then you flew the F-16, and where were the boards there?
So similar to a T-45 in a sense, except they were more vertically up and down. So just next to the engine, but when you put them out, two on each side, two up and two down kind of thing.
Yeah, so,
I don't know. It's hard to explain.
Well, yeah. I'm tracking it. But so kind of inboard of the stabs, right, would you say?
Right.
And then deploying mm-hmm, a clamshell yeah. fashion that was kind of oriented vertically as opposed to horizontally like the T-45. So totally with you. So anyway, basically, it comes down to a series of factors. And the biggest one for me, I thought, was aerodynamic influence. So usually you want to have it balanced. If there's an upper, it needs to be a lower. If there's a left, it needs to be a right. And that was all very true until we had flight control computers. Right, Jello? And then at that point, basically our FCS, our flight controls computers, FCCs, I should say, with the correct sensor input, they can accommodate anything, can't they?
Yeah. In fact, to your point, the Super Hornet does not have the same speed brake of the legacy Hornet. It has a couple little things that pop up, but then for the most part, it deflects flight control surfaces for the pilot in different manner that help act as a traditional large speed brake. But if you were to look at it individually, you might get some rudder deflection, some aileron deflection, some horizontal stabilator deflection, and you might think, wait, is it going to pitch, roll, or yaw? But again, to your point, the FCCs take care of that.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think they call that a speed brake function because there's no physical component that's just one isolated speed brake. So, yeah, I'm totally with you, dude. And actually, I really enjoyed, I don't know if that's the right word, but I liked the speed brake function on the Rhino. How did you feel about it compared to the Chuck?
I mean, it seemed to work, right? If you put out the speed brakes, it slows you down or helps you get down, whichever method you need at the time. So, yeah, no, I thought it worked fine.
Yeah, and there wasn't much of a pronounced pitch up or pitch down on deployment with a speed brake function in the Rhino, I thought.
Good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so it's pretty well balanced, and it's just like Jello said, it's kind of an over-deflection of the control surfaces in a very aerodynamically balanced nature so that the plane doesn't jostle around too much. So, anyway, perfect. That was a test pilot answer. Shall we move on?
Hey, that's why you're here, buddy. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, Dan, and all of our question submitters. Hopefully, we'll get to some more next time. All right. So why don't we get to the interview, Sunshine? You had a chance to listen. Any lead-in thoughts?
Yeah, dude. Holy cow. So Magua, love listening to his stuff. I had no idea. Oh, I just love the fact that he was an O-351 for, what, about 6 years or so. So he used to blow up tanks on the ground. And then the Marine Corps said, hey, why don't you go ahead and blow up tanks in the air? And I just absolutely love that. So it makes for a great story, right?
Well, let's let the listeners hear it for themselves. All right, let's get to it. All right, Viva Las Vegas, baby. Today, the Fighter Pilot Podcast is in Sin City. And joining me in studio is retired United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Scott. Magua, how you doing, bud?
Great. Thanks, Jill. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it's good to be here. And you live here, don't you?
I do.
Excellent.
I actually live here.
All right. Well, even though it's supposed to be 109 degrees today, bud.
It gets hot.
Well, hey, man, we're going to talk today about the Harrier. And you've flown that, so you're going to help us out. But first, let's get to know you. Where are you from? What was your career like? And what are you doing now?
Well, I'm from the Northern California Bay Area. I joined the Marine Corps out of high school. I went to boot camp. I actually was an enlisted grunt.
No kidding.
For 6 years.
What was your MOS?
0351, anti-tank assault man.
Whoa. So,
and then I went to college and got my degree and started flying planes for the Marine Corps. So, okay. And then I flew the Harrier, got selected to fly the Harrier.
Still busting tanks.
Yep, just from the air. So a little easier on my feet than carrying a pack around.
Yep.
And then I did that for a number of years. And then right before I retired, I got a chance to fly the F-35. I stood up the first operational squadron, the F-35, the Stovall variant, the F-35B, and then then retired, and now I work for Draken International, Director of Business Development, and I fly A-4 Skyhawks, L-159s, and L-39s.
In fact, you're in your flight suit right now. You got a flight today?
I do, yeah, this afternoon.
Well, I'm glad this worked out. We've been trying this, what, for months? And I finally flew in this morning. You picked me up, and we're here in the studio, and when we're done, you're going to drop me off and go take your flight, and I'll head back to San Diego. So pretty good gig.
Yeah, thanks for making that work out.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Well, I know you're going to wow us all with your information on the Harrier, so let's jump right into it. First off, tell me, how many hours do you have in the Harrier?
I have around 1,800 hours in the Harrier.
Okay. As many takeoffs as landings?
Yeah, just about, right. Yeah, and the Harrier doesn't have a long time on station, so I got them 1 hour at a time.
Right. No, I meant, did you ever have to?
Oh, I've never had to punch out of one. No, I've been asked that a few times, I've never had to.
Okay, fair enough. Well, realizing this aircraft has quite a history overseas, and the Marine Corps adopted it. Let's start at the beginning with as much information as you're able to pass on, and then we can maybe fill in some blanks later if necessary. We have always a lot of listeners who are happy to tell us what we missed on this show.
I'm sure.
But let's start with, what was the aircraft designed to do?
Well, the aircraft is designed as a light attack airplane, and it's fairly unique in that it's a STOVL aircraft, short takeoff, vertical landing.
Right.
At the time, I think it was called VSTOL, vertical short takeoff and landing. But, you know, it's was really designed that way by the British back more of a Cold War era type mindset where the runways possibly going to be bombed out in a war with Russia would be from the east there. And they would have to operate from hides and roadways and such like that. So they built it for that. And then they also bought amphibious ships. So they were able to buy ships that didn't have catapults on them and were able to take off and land without the assist of a catapult or wires with a hook. So the airplane was adaptable to, still had to have a flight deck, but not quite as big. The British really perfected that. And then the Marine Corps took that and adopted that for their own use from the amphibious concept and the Marine Expeditionary Unit using amphibious shipping because, well, the Navy had already spoken for all the big deck carriers, and those are quite expensive to make. So
yes,
they were able to kind of increase the number of carriers, if you will, and fixed-wing aircraft, or carriers that had fixed-wing aircraft by doing that.
So that's interesting because an aircraft that was designed theoretically for a Cold War scenario where runways might be damaged was adapted by the Marine Corps thinking, hey, once we get ashore, then what? We can set up some bases where our support aircraft can land, refuel, rearm.
That's right. From that concept, they could go to forward operating bases and quickly refuel and rearm. It still requires a fairly significant footprint in terms of just supporting an aircraft. So it's not quite like a helicopter in that regard, but it requires a little bit more support probably than your average helicopter. And it needs a little bit of runway, whether it's a road or an actual runway that like aluminum matting, an expeditionary type runway. But it still makes it a little flexible, a little adaptable. And when the Marine Expeditionary Unit travels, that is their indirect fire support because they don't bring artillery on the amphibious ships. So that's kind of their airborne artillery, if you will.
Not sure I knew that. So sometimes I get emails from wives, believe it or not, mostly, who say, my husband was playing your podcast on a road trip, and after the second or third one, I actually found I enjoyed it. And some of them tell me later that they don't really know that much about the aircraft that we speak with assumptions on. So let's go back to some basics here. What makes the Harrier a STOVL now instead of, I used to call it VSTOL, so I guess that's out. It's now STOVL?
Right, and the F-35B is officially STOVL, so that they've adopted that.
Well, what is it about the aircraft, though, that makes it able to take off and land vertically?
It has nozzles on the side. So the exhaust comes out of four nozzles, two on each side, and they're all interconnected, so they move together. You know, fully aft is, you know, normal flight.
When like you're a normal flying airplane. Around,
like a normal airplane. It still is not in the back of the airplane, so you're blowing some of your hot gas down the side of your airplane. But for the most part, yeah, it flies like a normal airplane once your nozzles are aft. However, you can move them, and when you move them, it actually takes bleed air from the engine and augments through various ducts in different positions on the wingtips and the front and the nose and the tail. So as you get slower, as it slows down for a, say, a vertical landing, as your aerodynamic flight controls become less and less effective to the point of not being effective at all, it takes high pressure air and blows them out these ducts to give you control in the different axes, whether roll or pitch, yaw. And they're all interconnected to the stick, so they all move with the stick and the rudder pedals. It's actually a pretty simple design, the way they did it, which is a good thing because for reliability, obviously. But it's pretty ingenious how they made it all work together and fly around and then land, you know, stop in the air and land, which I've flown it for many years, and I still look at it, and it's still impressive to me.
Well, and anyone who's seen a Harrier demonstration at an air show has been amazed usually because here's an airplane that you're used to seeing other aircraft like it go fast, and all of a sudden it comes in to show center and basically stops in midair and turns and faces the crowd and goes left and right and forward and back and dips its wings and bows. And it's funny, I actually was talking to my mother on the phone last night. I told her I was coming out for this interview. And I said, you know, the Harrier, your favorite. Because when she used to go to shows with us when I was kids, we were kids. That was always her favorite, was the Harrier, because it just amazed her that it would sit there. Of course, it was loud, but you would see it, and you could kind of see the smoke coming down a little bit, you know, some smoke in the engines, and it would just sit there and just look at you, and it looked menacing, because you would always have your gear and your flaps down and everything.
Yeah, it is, and then it looks really cool when you raise the gear when you're in the hover, the demonstration, they do that. That smoke that you talk about is actually water injection.
Really?
To keep the engine cooler. Yeah, it's distilled water that is injected into the hot section of the airplane, and it allows the RPM and the temperature, allows it to run a little bit more thrust out of the engine, so it can generate that extra power for hovering when needed. You had about 90 seconds of water in there. Yeah. Gives you, like I said, a little bit more thrust. Normally, water gives you less thrust, but because it allows the engine to operate at a higher temperature, it allows higher RPM. So net, you get a higher level of thrust. And actually, the turbine blades are operating above their melting point at their max.
If it wasn't for the water
injection and the small holes that are through the turbine blades try to keep them cooler.
Huh. So do you have a gauge or a meter or something that tells you how much water you have left, just like how much fuel you have left?
Exactly. Yeah? Yes. It's in pounds, like fuel. You have 500 pounds of water.
Okay.
You can use it for takeoff too, but generally it's used for landing. Hmm. Occasionally for takeoff, if you're heavyweight and you have a very short run, you can get a little extra thrust to reduce your takeoff distance.
And is this something you're doing, Magua, as the pilot, or is it something where you've commanded? For example, we just had the V-22 episode, which is also in this category, and the pilot there, Sweet Pea, had said that, you know, certain things he can put in as a vote, if you will, but the airplane just won't let him do it. Are you controlling the water here, or is it a result of something you're asking for?
You have an input. It's a switch, and the switch is three positions off, takeoff and land. After that, it is based on, depending on what position it's in, based on throttle position and temperature or RPM, and it can hit one or the other first. And again, it depends on what position that you select in, whether it's takeoff or land. Takeoff, it'll flow a little bit sooner based on RPM. So as you hit your RPM and then starts flowing, you're just going to, you know, get that. So a lot of times the RPM will, you'll hit your max RPM first, and then the temperature will continue to rise, and then it'll, you know, start flowing if it's in land mode, and then it'll cool it down about 15 degrees Celsius is what.
All right.
But that black smoke is, it's water that's come out. And you probably have seen it like in a B-52.
Sure.
They have water injection as well, similar to that.
We've recorded that episode, but we haven't played it yet. So yes, that does come up in our discussion. Now we've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole here, but that's all right. It's kind of fun. Let's talk about though the controls for hover or whatever you would call the just, you know, hovering. In a regular fighter like my F-18, I have a stick and throttle, which I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
But I don't have maneuverable exhaust like you do. So how do you control that?
Next to the throttle on on your left hand, there's a knob, a little lever inside the throttle. It just goes fore and aft, and that sets your nozzle angle.
Okay.
So when you move that, the nozzle's moved. It's a air motor that runs off the engine, and it uses a chain to connect the nozzles.
Yeah,
like a motorcycle chain. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. It really is that. Like a strong one. It's simple. Yeah. It works.
That's the point.
But, and then it rotates, you know, they rotate around these rings. And you can go from full aft, which is zero, to there's a stop that you'll hit. It's called hover stop.
Okay.
And that's 82 degrees down. The fuselage is an 8-degree datum, so that's basically 90 degrees to your datum. And then you can lift it up and move it further aft over a ledge, and that'll go to 98 degrees. So it's really 16 degrees forward, and that's called braking stop. That's full braking stop. Anywhere in there, you can select any degrees, you know, between 0 and 98 that you want. It'll help you slow down faster. If you're stopped, it will back you up. Even on the ground, you can use it as sort of a thrust reverser, like not as powerful as probably typical ones, but it still does some, it still helps with that. And then when you move the nozzles from aft out of zero, a butterfly valve from the engine opens up automatically from zero, I think, to 36 degrees, if I remember correctly. It's been a few years, but I'm pretty sure that's all right.
Okay.
That's full open. At 36 and beyond of nozzle angle, the butterfly valve is fully open, and it takes bleed air off the engine to go to those ducts that I mentioned before that are interconnected to the stick and rudder that just takes that bleed air to help your flight controls and pitch you on roll.
So if you are in the hover in this air show, going back to that example, and you want to slide a little bit left down the flight line, a little bit right? Are you literally just doing that with a stick, a little left?
Yes.
What
so,
would be normal?
So with a Harrier, there's a lot of movements you have. So yeah, okay. You roll with the stick a little bit, but then you want to keep your yaw. You don't want the nose to necessarily pitch that way if you're trying to keep it. So in this example of the air show, you want to look fairly symmetrical to the crowd line or perpendicular. So
sure.
You have to offset that with a little. So if you want to go right, so you do right stick.
Right.
And then you do just a tiny bit of left rudder pedal to keep the nose straight. You would just feed it in as you feel it trying to yaw to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you're taking bleed air and porting it out of these ducts. So you're losing some thrust out of them. So you have to modulate with the throttle. So every input requires, it's constant.
It's like a drummer.
Moving.
Every limb is doing something.
It is. And it is a constant. Everything's constantly moving. Okay. So you're working that.
Are there fly-by-wire flight controls?
No. They have a stability augmentation and attitude hold system. So the stability system does help without that, because that can fail for whatever reason. And you have to train to that. So it's a much higher workload. And I've been told, I did not fly the AV-8A, that it's similar to flying the AV-8A, and that is, you're moving everything. It's like pedaling a bicycle. You know, your feet are moving in yaw, right, trying to continue to keep that thing straight.
So will it save you from yourself if, again, getting back to this air show, if you just ham-fist it and go too far to the right or not enough rudder, is it going to stop you or is it going to go into the ground?
It won't stop you from doing anything. The Harrier, it's all the pilot, so... Uh-huh. It's great, but it's not very forgiving. Mm-hmm. I will say that about the Harrier. So if the pilot wants to do something
stupid
that shouldn't do, dumb, it won't protect you from that. So it'll keep going to the right until you put a opposite movement in to stop it. So if you, in this instance or this example, where you are sliding to the right, you keep sliding, you want to stop sliding to the right, you have to then put left stick back in and kind of counter, almost kind of like being on skates and trying to do a hockey stop. You just keep gliding along until you stop yourself.
Okay. I just never have obviously flown one of those, and that just seems crazy. Just as a quick aside, without going into too much detail, is the F-35B similar? Or
no, it's completely different.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
Does that make it hard to transition?
You know, it's great. The F-35B is great for somebody who's never done STOVL before. I think it's actually easier for somebody who hasn't than it is for a Harrier guy, because you have to unlearn some of the things you've learned.
Okay.
Now, it's not impossible, obviously. Right. I mean, I've done it. It's actually brilliant the way they designed it, and it's all fly-by-wire. You just tell it what you want to do, and it just does it.
But that's the difference in 30 years of technology also.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we've yet to have, and we really owe it to the audience, but we've yet to have an F-35 episode. So hopefully we'll get to that soon. And someone who's our guest on that show hopefully has flown the B model could tell us about it. All right. So let's retract all the rope that we took down this rabbit hole and go all the way back up to basically designed as a jump jet adapted from the British for the Marine Corps, and they've used it successfully in multiple conflicts over the last, 20, 30 years that you guys have been flying it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's going to keep flying, I believe, right, for another...
It's got, let's see, probably another 9-10 years left in it.
So in all that, really, for the Marine Corps, it comes down to supporting the grunts on the ground, right? So
absolutely.
Our next question generally on the aircraft series here is, what does it do well? What would you say, is there one mission that is its bread and butter?
Yeah, absolutely. Close air support is what it really, the Marine Corps focuses on that mission.
And again, that is the point. And we just on the last episode had a discussion on forward air controllers. So that's good that we can now follow it up with the AV-8B. Do you do, in fact, the FAC mission, FAC-A in the Harrier?
Yes. So not all Harriers are single seat, but all the combat Harriers, we'll put it that way, are single seat.
Mm-hmm.
There's trainers that are not, but everything used in combat. So once they went to a single seat FAC-A, once they accepted that as in the Marine Corps, it has done FAC-A.
Really? Now, it's because last time Chile and my guest and I were kind of opining that the Navy and the Marine Corps only uses multi-seat. And for the F-18, I believe the Marine Corps uses the D for that.
They do. And they do single seat FAC-A in the Marine Corps Hornets as well.
Okay.
But it's certainly, two seat. It's when you don't have to keep your hands on the throttle and stick, it allows you to be probably a little bit better as a FAC-A. Really, the big thing is a tempo, just because they can focus on the radio. I got controls from a two-seat FAC-A from the back seater, obviously. They were actually at the tanker. while they were giving me type 3 control in Iraq. And
wow.
There's no way a single seater could ever do that, as you know.
Yes, that's true. Oh, wow. Okay. Now, does everybody do FAC-A and Harrier or only
no.
certain? Did you?
No, I did not. Okay. It was just coming around as all I right. was actually at a weapons school instructor, but I did not. I mean, I did a lot of close air support, obviously, but
right.
and I've done FAC-A escort, had to help out with that. I haven't done that myself, no.
Okay.
It's probably the only one I... Well, qualification I didn't do.
Well, that's got to be pretty crazy, a single seat, because according to our guest last week, like I said, Chile, there's a lot of coordination. You're working with the folks on the ground, all the radios, the dynamic environment of the situation changing, plus handling the stack. So that's got to be pretty challenging. So CAS is its bread and butter. Now, it has since, though, earned an ability, or I don't know if earned is the right word, but it has some air-to-air ability, does it not?
It does, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean... Okay. It always has, even back in the days, you know, mm-hmm. it was AIM 9 only, but back when AIM 9 was more used in the Falklands, the British mm-hmm. used the Sea Harrier quite a bit there. But it has grown with the radar, and it now carries AIM 120.
AMRAAM, sure.
Right. So it does have a air-to-air capability.
Okay. And it has the same radar, I believe, as my trusty old Legacy Hornet, the APG-65.
It does,
okay.
yeah.
Very cool. So I'm familiar with that. Now, you touched on the Sea Harrier. Let's see if we can get through the variants. And okay. I only say let's see because I assume you know them, but I don't. I know there's some GR terminology, and we've talked about that before on this show with our Tornado guest. But we've got some Aviate A's, and then we only have B's in the Marine Corps, I believe, right?
We now only have B's.
Okay.
Yeah, we had Aviate
oh, that's
A's,
right. yeah.
and then we transitioned completely to Aviate B's, which are really different airplanes. I would liken it to a Hornet / Super Hornet.
Oh.
You know,
they
carry the same name, but they're very different airplanes. And they look similar, but...
I read that they redesigned the wing and...
Completely,
okay,
yeah.
so
it's a much... It's a bigger airplane. Definitely, yeah, the
different
whole airplane
canopy
is...
Canopy arrangement for the cockpit. Okay. So let's start at the beginning. At least, not every, obviously, obscure one, but what was the beginning and where are we at now?
Well, at the beginning, you have, you know, some of the test variants that mm-hmm. the British came up with, the Stovall capability, the Kestrel and the P-1127, I believe it was.
Okay. Demonstrators.
Really,
maybe?
Yeah. They were just trying to demonstrate the concept and test it out. And then they started building Harriers from that. And they've had some different variants. I remember all the GR variants typically are the GR-7s and GR-9s were the last ones they flew in the Royal Air Force. Those were probably similar to our night attack variant. Didn't have a radar. The Sea Harriers that the Royal Navy, British Royal Navy flew, that are very similar to our Aviate A's. However, they put a radar in them. Our Aviate A's did not have a radar. The Blue Vixen radar was actually a very good radar, and they carried AMRAAM years ago before any U.S. Harriers ever had an AMRAAM. And in the U.S., we started with the Aviate A. Like I said, it's a kind of a derivative of the Sea Harrier. From that transition to the Aviate B, entirely new airplane, the Aviate B, the first ones were called day attacks, and they didn't have a radar. They weren't really night systems cockpits. And then they changed that to the Aviate B, which first ones were the night attack, which were night systems cockpits. And they had a forward-looking infrared on the nose of the airplane that was a navigational infrared. And it had a more powerful engine, so it could carry more and, you know, have better performance mm-hmm. On vertical. Significantly more thrust than the the Aviate B, the day attack version. And the Aviate A, for that matter. And then they went to the Aviate B. That was called the Harrier 2, and then the Harrier 2 Plus, which they put the radar in it. So they call it the radar / night attack. It's got all the same capabilities as the night attack, but with the APG-65, as you mentioned. So, you know, you have a air-to-air mm-hmm. multi-mode radar
right.
in the airplane. And it's probably close to about 80-20 percentage-wise, maybe 75-25 around there. I used to know the numbers exactly. I don't know how it's changed, but they actually remanufactured some day attacks to the Aviate, to the radar jets.
Okay.
And they took the wing, they kept the wing, which is interesting because the wing was one of the first carbon composite wings built. Mm-hmm. And they built it so strong because they weren't sure how long it would last initially that they overbuilt it. And they said it's got an indefinite life on it, which rarely we see engineers say that about anything. So,
particularly aircraft.
Right. So they were able to just remanufacture it and call it a zero using the same wing, zero life airframe from the same wing. So,
And did it stop at the B? Is there any talk about a C or is this aircraft?
There might have been talk about a C years ago, but it stopped at the B.
Okay.
Yeah, the B had the AVAP Harrier, the AVAP Harrier 2, and the AVAP Harrier 2 Plus.
Okay.
So it's day attack, night attack, radar night attack.
Gotcha. But then there's some two-seat variants. You alluded to that earlier.
There are, yes. So that's the TAV-8B, okay, which is essentially a two-seat version of the day attack that they did put the bigger engine in it, but that's about it. It has no sensors to speak of. It's really a trainer. It can use some weapons. It's just for training purposes, really. Mm-hmm. It's not a combat aircraft.
Sure.
By any means.
The idea being, though, when you're going through training, you have an instructor in the back, and obviously it makes it a little bit more of a safer process.
Absolutely.
I don't know if it's a TA-8 or whatever, but there's a guy, I guess, in North Carolina who owns a two-seat Harrier.
He does. Yeah, Art Nalls. Oh, yeah. I've sat in his single-seat Harrier.
Oh, you have?
Yes, I have. Yeah. He bought their former British airplanes.
Okay.
So they're variants of the GR. I don't know what model, but mm-hmm. Yeah, he flies them at air shows. He was one of the original test pilots, I think, of the AV-8B. He said he has more engine out time in a Harrier than any human being because he did all the air start testing for the Harrier. So, a brave man.
Yeah, I hope they gave him hazardous duty pay for that. So, yeah, now he has two of these, one single seat, one two seat, and he flies them to air shows and keeps, that's crazy.
He does. Right.
Well, that gives me hope. I think someday I should buy my own F-18. So we'll see. Anyway, awesome.
It's not inexpensive, but.
It's not inexpensive. Double. Oh, yeah. Okay. I got you. All right. So we didn't cover every iteration of the GRs, but like you said, we got the GRs as well, and then the AV essentially.
If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation while keeping your feet on the ground, then Air Corps Aviation is the place for you. Since 2008, Air Corps Aviation has been at the forefront of modernizing the airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating back to World War II. Their dedicated team specializes in numerous aerospace disciplines, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, all while incorporating state-of-the-art technology. In 2024, Air Corps Aviation is expanding its team with job openings in engineering and computer-aided design, quality, fabrication, and restoration. Live where others vacation in northern Minnesota while enjoying paid time off, health insurance and savings accounts, retirement plans, life insurance, and best of all, most Fridays off. If you're ready to be a part of a team fulfilling dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircorpsaviation.com/careers and take your first step towards an exciting career in aviation. That's aircorpsaviation.com/careers. Visit today.
Okay, and let's go on to armament. Now, I read about 9 weapon stations, right?
Really, it's got, let's see, 7. If you count the center line.
Okay.
And the 9, probably the British versions have a station on the outrigger.
Okay.
Where the outrigger wheels go. So they put AIM-9s on there. So mm-hmm. they do have 9.
And then on those weapon stations, what can we carry? Just about everything seems
yeah,
like?
Yeah. Most of the general purpose type ordnance, mm-hmm. Up to 1,000 pounds, they don't carry a 2,000 pounder.
Okay.
They'll carry, you know, rockets, gun. It has a gun.
Internal?
It's not internal. Well, it's. Okay. It's mounted on the bottom, so you can take it on or off.
Okay.
So it's external, but it's in strake, so it doesn't take a weapon station okay. up by putting it on there.
Hmm.
Just adds weight. It's a Gal 12, 25 millimeters, so it's actually pretty big rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Same Gatling gun that's on the side of an AC-130. It's the same gun as that.
Okay.
And then in the other stations, like I said, rockets, missiles like Maverick, and then you can carry your air-to-air weapons, AIM-9, AIM-120. There was really the only air-to-air weapons.
They didn't bother putting an AIM-7 on, I'm guessing.
Never.
With the,
they kind of skipped that. They didn't have the radars when that was out. So no, it's just Fox 3, no Fox 1.
On the jet. How about fancy weapons, like any kind of HARM?
It does not carry HARM,
no. It's not really
I think
the
years ago, it was a sidearm. I don't know if you ever heard of that thing. It was able to carry sidearm, which is essentially an AIM-9 that was HARM-like. But you know the range of the AIM-9, so and you know the range of surface air systems. So that's
not a fair fight.
No, it's not what you're looking for. Like,
maybe they thought it was like a self-defense if you're being shot at by the thing anyway.
Maybe.
Send something back their way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if somebody told you to go out and you had a seed or deed mission where you're carrying a sidearm, you have to think that they didn't like you.
Make sure your paperwork is up to date before you go,
yes.
right? All right. What about, as far as you said, general purpose weapons? can you slap fancy things on them? So laser guided.
Sure. Laser guided.
JDAM?
Yeah, JDAM and laser guided. So it has 1760 wiring for smart weapons like JDAM and AMRAAM. And then obviously the laser guided variants and, and some of the multi mode variants where they're laser slash GPS guided.
Okay. I thought I read, I don't know, maybe it's the naval version for the UK, but a Harpoon or some sort of.
Not the US variant. Okay, I don't, I'm not sure if the, they may, but I don't know.
Obviously that's not really in the Harrier's, again, wheelhouse is you shouldn't be out there looking to take down ships. That should be
well,
the Navy.
You know, honestly, we did train to that. And the best weapon that we had before that at one point was the IR Maverick because it had, it was able to distinguish the heat and the water pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think we gave all those to the Navy P3 community. So they can take out the ships.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was really the weapon probably of choice for any type of anti-shipping.
Okay. How about cluster munitions before they fell out of favor?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Cluster munitions. And I've dropped quite a few in combat actually. So yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, how about performance? I mean, how high, how fast, how many Gs have you been in this thing?
I've been up to 41,000 feet trying to get over thunderstorms, but it's an air breather. So it's a, I guess it would be a medium bypass turbofan, but it doesn't go quite, you know, it's not F-22 like, not even like Hornet, I guess I would say. It starts to suffer a little bit. And also the wing. Mm-hmm. So it, every aircraft obviously doesn't turn great up at those altitudes, but it seems to struggle a little bit more. And I've, I used to have to go up when I did functional check flights up to those altitudes to make sure everything was working properly. Speed-wise, it's transonic, so it's not a supersonic airplane.
Okay.
Most probably call it subsonic, but technically it's transonic. It goes up to 1.0, you know, on paper.
What's the closest you saw?
You know, I've gotten to 0.94 and it started doing a, just straight and level, and it started just doing a slight rhythmic wing rock at 1.94. I think that's probably, you're starting to have some shock-induced flow separation on the wing, and that's not good because the probe is actually mounted externally on the left outside of the intake. So you have a little
probe?
Yes.
Okay.
That causes, I think, a little asymmetric issues with the airplane. Just it's
you reached your comfort limit.
Yeah,
there?
It was okay. A little bit slower than that.
All right. How about G's? What's the most you ever pulled in it?
7.5 for me, but it was up to 8G rated.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't shabby, but it would bleed rapidly, so it, the wing shape was not.
I never had a chance to fight one. Did you guys do much swirling? I mean, and is it pretty good in a dogfight?
You know, I fought Hornets before. I mean, I would say it's not looked at as one of the premier dogfighters in the world.
It's not.
You know, in the hands of the right person, it had very harsh high-speed departure characteristics.
Oh.
Slow speed, it's fine. It's very benign. But high speed, I've seen some bad things, not personally, from other people.
Heard of.
High speed and it's not very good with loaded rolls. So if somebody puts a lot, you know, high speed and does a loaded roll, it could come. I've seen somebody go 340 degrees in a second, just swap ends from a high speed departure.
Wow.
So that was kind of rough. Okay. And they rub the engine rubs, so it was an engine pull. So it really it's, depends on the pilot as anything.
Sure.
If the pilot can fly it towards its limits, it'll do decent, but it won't. Hornet's much better. I fought them. I mean, again, pilot dependent, but you take the same pilot level in both airplanes, and a Hornet's definitely a better dogfighter for sure.
Did you use the nozzles in a fight?
Very limited situations. Okay. You know, and I used to teach as an air combat instructor, I would teach this. And if guys can't fly to the conventional limits of the airplane because they're still trying to get that good, then there's no reason to use the nozzles because you'll bleed rapidly, so you lose a lot of your energy. There's certain times, so if you get in a very slow speed fight, you can bring a little bit in, and that will actually help because, as I mentioned before, your flight control surfaces, which is you obviously get slower, your aerodynamic flight controls are less effective. The ducts can actually help you, and then you can get a little bit of extra pitch. So if you're maybe getting close to a shot or something like that, you can get a quick, but it's a sacrifice, so you better take it to survive or you take it to get that shot.
Right.
But if you just take it and you're not getting anything like that out of it, then you're just bleeding for no reason. Okay. So
how about energy addition? Can it get speed back pretty quickly or?
No.
No.
Nope.
Okay.
Not at all.
It's got a pretty big wing, it seems like.
It does. Okay. It does. And it's an air breather. It does better down low. Mm. It loses performance probably more rapidly than most jets going uphill. So
okay. no one ever likes this part, but strengths and weaknesses. So I'm trying to rebrand this into what did you really love about the aircraft and what, if you had enough money, would you have fixed that for whatever reason they never fixed?
You know, I think most of what they can fix in terms of its reliability, and it's had some reliability challenges. I think the biggest thing about weaknesses are it's very maintenance intensive. It's very difficult. It needed a lot more engine changes than probably most airplanes that I've noticed. And the engine changes were significantly challenging because you would have to take the wing, the entire wing off the top with a crane and then lift the engine out from the top. And that's extremely intrusive to the airplane. It took a lot of man hours.
I would think.
Everything in that airplane is jammed in there pretty tightly. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, as I mentioned before, the hot exhaust, which is the rear nozzles, blow over all the avionics and your heat of your airplane. So it requires a lot of man hours. The maintenance guys are the heroes of that airplane.
Yeah.
By far.
Well, I would say you could say that about almost every airplane.
That's true.
You know, and I've owed the listener also an episode on our maintainers because they are the heroes, and I definitely need to get them on here.
That is.
Do you remember an advertised man hour per flight hour type of rate?
Oh, you know, I don't remember right now, but it was pretty high. You know, engine change, I think they listed like 400 man hours. And that's assuming you don't have any problems in the engine change.
Well, that was like an A4, though, where you literally pulled the airplane in half. I mean, on an F-18, you can roll a rack or whatever you'd call the thing under an engine and drop it out of there, and it's no big deal. But on a Harrier, it's almost like the very skeleton of the aircraft, it seems
like. It is. And you had to use cranes to lift everything out, and it's very tightly put in the aircraft. So it's not forgiving to pilot error. It's also not very forgiving to maintenance error as well. Single engine airplane, you know. And then on the weaknesses side of the tactical portion, as I mentioned, the heat goes all back down the side of the airplane, but that also makes the whole backside of the airplane kind of hot, not just the tail, like all the way aft, the middle of the airplane. So it's fairly, it's a big target for any kind of heat seeking type of thing.
Which is where you guys are down rooting around.
Right.
And it's ground forces.
It has, you know, no, I mean, it's also a giant radar reflector. It's got big fan blades in the front. It's, but it does carry a lot of expendables, you know, more than average, like 180, so quite a few. So
chaff and flares.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it needs them, so it's good. Right. And it's not supersonic. You know, it's doesn't have longest legs, but it is pilot vehicle interface, probably one of the best I've seen, and that includes the F-35. I would say it's better than the F-35, not in the sensors it has, but in just the interaction between the pilot and the aircraft.
Really?
It is actually impressive, and we've had a lot of Hornet guys come over to the simulator from the weapons school, and actually we're quite impressed with how well everything was laid out and set up for the pilot. So I think it was good at that. It was great at close air support. You have great visibility, that bubbly canopy that also has a lot of drag, so you can look down at where you're landing. Also, it gives you, you're almost kind of sitting in the clouds, you know, kind of sitting up high. And so it's good for close air support. It's good for the mission it does, you know, and there are sacrifices for the STOVL capability, just in terms of, like I said, how the airplane's put together on the maintenance side and weight, because it can only be so heavy and so it can vertically land.
Speaking of that, I've always wondered, did you guys have a procedure in your pocket checklist for find a place to land and land? Or does it have to be certain surfaces?
So, it depends on what kind of landing. And one of the interesting things about Harrier is you can do anything from a vertical landing to a conventional landing and everywhere in between.
Okay.
So, yes, if you're going to do a vertical landing, you need to land on sealed concrete. Concrete's usually formed in blocks. So, if there's no seal between the blocks, the actual pressure will build up and lift the block out.
Wow.
So, So, that's not good. Aluminum matting works as well as, you know, the flight deck of ships. But if, like asphalt, it'll melt the asphalt. However, if you keep 5 knots of forward speed, it'll not melt the asphalt. So you can, as long as you have some forward velocity, you can kind of keep the asphalt from melting. And, and most airports don't like it if you destroy their airports. So.
Yeah, no, I would think not. But if you're just flying along and you have a problem that's, you know what, I need to probably either land or I may have to eject soon. Was there either a procedure, official or otherwise, ready room banter about look for a decent blank part of the highway and
roads. Yeah, you can you can easily land on a road. Like I said, if you get 5 knots of forward speed, you can land there. So you're not, you know, nobody wants to land on a highway and then like conventionally at, you know, 140 knots and then try to stop. Who knows what car, but if you're going 5 knots, it's pretty easy to stop once you land. So yes, that has always been in the thought process of any Harrier pilot. If you get in a situation like that, I think there was a story. I've seen a picture of it and heard the backstories before my time of somebody actually landing out at some farm.
Like to see their folks or something?
No, I think it was an emergency.
Okay. Good.
And they went out there, changed the engine, and they took off. They fixed the airplane and took off for, like, you know, it's like a grass takeoff, which they used to practice that. And the British used to do that even more. Okay. They used to do grass.
Getting back to the first point you made about the Cold War.
Right.
Okay. If it went hot.
Yeah, it does have some other outs, I guess, if you will, you know, if the airport's not available.
Okay. You know, I forgot to put it on the agenda here, Magua. Can we talk about ship ops real quick?
Yeah, sure.
So the British have ski ramps. We don't. What does that offer, and why don't you think we ever did it?
Well, it offers you to take off with less takeoff roll and with more weight. So it offers you better performance for your takeoff. It's a significant boost in your ability to get airborne with, you know, given weight. We did not do that because our ships don't have that built into them. Mm-hmm. Those ships were designed, the British ships, for Harriers as the primary platform. But when we go on a Mew, the Harrier is not the primary platform. It is a platform, and there's a lot of helicopters on that ship. Mm-hmm. And a ski ramp takes a lot of the parking space off of the deck because you can't really park anything on the ramp. So we lose a lot of space on the deck, and that's really why it kind of becomes an issue for us.
So when you're on an amphibious ship and you go to do your takeoff run, what are you doing in the cockpit? Are the nozzles in one position the whole time and you're just changing the throttle, or are you moving nozzles too?
So,
because you're not on a catapult like I am in my F-18.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct. So you're just on a center line, basically the tram line. You're just on that tram line. You do some engine run-ups, some checks, and then once they tap the deck, the launch officer, he'll tap the deck and launch you, and then you go, your nozzles are at, I believe it was 10 degrees. Yeah, for the ship takeoff, it was 10 degrees.
Okay.
And you just go full power, and you keep it tracking down the tram line just with your own.
Sure.
You have to do it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then as you reach, there's a perpendicular line at the end of the ship. It's called the nozzle rotation line. Once you reach that, you move the nozzles to a set position. It can be 55, 60, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's already calculated for you. They've done it up in the tower.
Right.
And a guy holds a board before and he tells you, based on your weight, and then you make sure it all matches what you're thinking, and then it tells you exactly what nozzle angle set, and you set a little stop there, like a temporary stop on your nozzle lever, and then you just pull it back to that stop.
Nice.
And then it also tells you what trim to set, so the airplane will seek the right attitude once it comes off the deck.
Did you find this to be, I mean, for me, hearing it for the first time, it sounds kind of complex and maybe a little bit harrowing. I mean, was it routine after a while for you guys, or was there any part of it that was
the fear? There is that you lose some kind of thrust because you know, but it'd be like a cold catch shot, you know, that'd be like, you know, you're riding the silk at that point, obviously. But you know, the L class ships have a flat bottom and they bounce around a little bit more, I think, than the CVs, but all the ships bounce around, and you know how it is. So when the nose pitches down, if you have a good launch officer who's done it for a little while, he'll time it right. So when you come off the deck, it's on an upswing of the bow.
Oh, of the ship in the waves.
But if you don't, he'll see the upswing in the bow, then tap the deck. But by the time you get to the end of the deck, it's already going down. And so you launch straight at the water, which is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, because you guys are probably lower, closer to the water on those ships than on a carrier.
Yeah, about 50 feet off the LHAs. I think 60 on the LHDs or so. But
So you go out, you do your mission. When it's time to come back, on fixed, you didn't do any fixed wing stuff, right? Harrier or Hornets, I mean, or anything?
No.
Okay.
No.
But you're probably familiar from your career. So for us coming back the daytime, landings were a challenge, but they're, you know, they got to the point where they were fun. Night landings were never fun. Didn't matter how many years of experience you had. What's landing a Harrier like for you guys? Is it, again, just kind of a task to do?
Oh,
or was
ship?
There an element, of danger or fear?
Well, yeah. You know, like anything, right? Mm-hmm. If the conditions are good and the sea state's nice, and then it's not too bad. Well, it's different than the land. For one, you're going to have an LSO in there who's on the radio with you the whole time.
Is he a pilot like you?
He is. He's it is a qualification that pilots get. It's a duty that you have for that day.
Yeah, we've talked about it similar for the F-18 and carrier stuff.
Right. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very similar to that. Although in this, the pilot's up in the tower, so he's almost at your eye level when you're crossing the deck. He's kind of up there. And you're basically hovering, but the ship's moving, so you're flying formation off the ship in a hover.
Wow.
So instead of like a land-based hover where that you're just stopping and you're actually still moving, but you zero out the relative motion, like, you know, like formation.
And you're moving at the same speed as the ship.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. So you stay over the same spot and then the LSO will clear you to land, mm-hmm. which then you set your rate of descent and you just come down and land. And the LSO tries to time that, you know, and get you in a good spot. And then you just try to keep it centered and land. If the ship's moving a lot, it becomes a little trickier.
Right.
For one of the spots, there's a hover position indicator, but it's not roll stabilized. So if the ship's moving, it's fairly useless.
Okay.
And you can't just keep chasing the formation flying off the ship when it's rolling. So you just have to look out at the horizon and just try to keep that level.
Jeez.
Yeah, so, and just, and then trust the LSO when you come down with, that it's going to work out.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to expose my naivete here, Magua. In my F-18, once I roll into the groove or at night coming in close, I mean, I need forward velocity to fly.
Right.
Can't you just stop, go back up a few feet? Go away. I mean, I can also take my own wave off. We don't generally want to do that. But I mean, I'm kind of committed is what I'm saying. And I'm not trying to say I'm better because I flew an F-18. But if you don't like how it's going, can you just add a power and go back up a few feet? Or once you start coming down, are you pretty well committed?
You can. Typically, probably doesn't happen so much. I mean, you're constantly manipulating the power and all the controls to keep your position. But once you start coming down, you set your rate of descent and then you catch it and can keep it where it's at. Yeah. So if you got too much rate of descent, or the LSO says hover, basically he's telling you get back up to your stabilized hover and you would add power and climb back up. Typically it doesn't have, once the LSO clears you to land, as long as you just set your rate of descent, you don't need to do that, but you can. You don't have a lot of fuel because you have to be low enough on fuel. So you need greater than a 1-to-1 thrust to weight to hover. Once you're low enough on fuel, you don't have a lot of excess gas because you have already burned down to a weight that is already calculated, and every jet has its own, based on its particular engine performance, its own hover calculations. Mm-hmm. You cross that deck at a certain state, fuel and water state, mm-hmm. and time, a Charlie time, right? But it doesn't usually give you a lot to go around the pattern, say. Mm-hmm. So you're fairly committed. You have a little bit of time in the hover, but and it also depends on how hot it is outside. So the hotter it is, the less weight you can carry, the lower fuel state you have when you cross that deck. You get to pretty much be trick or treat at the landing. So
very similar concepts, but I'm guessing you don't have a tanker hanging out overhead for you guys, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Although they're talking about making variants of the V-22.
Really?
Yeah. Refueling capability. So,
all right. Well, maybe that'll be a future opportunity. Okay. So if you took off with a, say, full combat load, or maybe even it doesn't have to be that much, but in other words, if you have a problem, you can't just turn around and come back. You either have to jettison some bombs or burn down your fuel or possibly both.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, it depends on, you know, if you're in a cold climate, you may be able to bring some of the ordnance back, but certainly the fuel. I couldn't think of a time when you have enough performance, even on the best of days, to hover with a full load of fuel in the airplane. You would have to.
Now you can back at the field because you can do a rolling, like conventional style.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. You can.
But you don't do that kind of landing on the boat, even as a contingency.
Never. It's not. They will have you punch out before you even try that.
Wow. Really?
So, yeah.
Okay. Man, all right. I've learned a lot about this airplane. It's pretty cool. How about notoriety? So the F-14 has Top Gun and Top Gun has the F-14. Where would viewers of movies have seen the Harrier?
Well, True Lies is probably the...
Of course.
Arnold.
Everybody's,
right. And the Marine Corps actually flew airplanes in support of that movie.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, yeah.
That looked like real flying. I mean,
There was some of it was real flying, not all of it, obviously.
Not with Arnold.
The part where they were hovering by and shooting the gun into the building, that was all Hollywood. That was not real flying. Marine Corps did not do that.
What about the AIM-9 that launches the bad guy? That's realistic. I mean,
I'm pretty sure the Marine Corps didn't do that either, but.
Yeah. So yeah, True Lies is one of my favorites. I thought it was well represented.
Yeah.
I mean, they're hosing bullets into the water when the truck is on the bridge or whatever, but you know.
Yeah.
I also love that Hollywood thinks that we just fly around fully armed all the time.
Right.
Harrier, Mavericks and bullets and all that.
Right, yeah, just for random trading, yes.
Okay. Otherwise, it has been in Iraq and Afghanistan for as long as we've been there. It was involved in the Falklands. You started talking about that, and I think that was right after the early model came out, right? Didn't it go down like right away and get involved?
I don't know how long after, but it was early in its development. But that was just really big. It's kind of first big
debut.
You know, yeah, it was. Yeah. And it did a good job, you know, shooting down A4s and Super A10 dards that the Argentinians had. Yeah. And some of them got shot down too, some of the carriers, but they were kind of defending the ships.
Yeah, that's what needed to be done at the time. I guess some other notoriety, although not particularly positive, is that a squadron in Afghanistan was involved in what they call the greatest loss of aircraft in one setting, or maybe Marine aircraft, since Vietnam. I think on the way over, you were saying, did you know the training officer of that?
I did. Yeah, great friend of mine, yeah.
So this was Camp Bastion, Western, I think it is, Afghanistan, 2016?
2015. Anyway. It's been longer than that. It's 2013.
So we had a 4 deployed squadron of Harriers, and just give us a quick summary of what happened there.
Yeah, so 6 Harriers, they were all on deck, and that's all of the Harriers that they had brought on this detachment. And Lieutenant Colonel Chris Rabel was the commanding officer of the squadron. The bad guys infiltrated the base by posing in, you know, U.S. military clothing, fatigues, you know, camouflage utilities, and got through the ISAF was guarding the perimeter at the time.
That's the, International Security Assistance Force?
Right. So various countries who contribute, you know. Yeah, so whatever countries, they provide some security forces there. But in any case, they got through the wire. It was nighttime, and they actually got right up to the Harriers, put machine guns under the wings, and were shooting into the hangar at the Marines, who were mechanics and such, you know, aircraft mechanics, who weren't armed at the time. So everybody's running for cover and
chaos, I'm sure.
Yeah, and Lieutenant Colonel Rabel went back, had his driver go back to his billeting and grab his weapon, and you know, went out and kind of led from the front like he was known to do. Like his completely his personality, but unfortunately, again, an RPG got too close to him and gave him a fatal wound. And him and Sergeant Bradley Atwater, they were the two that passed away. But all the bad guys died.
Okay.
Unfortunately, all the Harriers were destroyed as well. So we were shooting basically. To kill them, we had to destroy the Harriers.
Yeah, that must have been a tough loss. But, man, true to the Marine Corps, I bet they love him because when I think of you guys, that's what I think of. I wouldn't expect anything less.
He especially definitely as embodied the spirit of the Marine Corps and everything he did. I remember we were both weapons school instructors at the same time and new students, you know, show up. And he walked up to one of the new students. He was actually in the Hornet shop, you know, big eyes. Oh, you know, I'm a weapons school. You know, it's the hazing part, I guess. But he poked him in the chest. Just it's kind of how he was. He was just kind of messing with him a little bit. But he goes, when I see the enemy, I run towards him. What do you do? And it always stuck with me because that's how he died, which is very interesting because that's how he lived his life. And, you know, the student looked at him and was like, sir, but, you know, kind of big eyes like, oh, is this a trick question? He started thinking about how he's supposed to answer it anyway. Wow. He was just messing with him. But that's what he did. He charged at the enemy, you know, led from the front and... Unfortunately, you know, he passed away, but...
did he leave a family? But
he did, yeah. 2 daughters and a son and his wife.
Oh, gosh. That's tough to hear, but, you know, that is the world we live in, and he did his duty.
Yeah, he did, and he did it well. He was a great pilot, a great man.
Cool. Well, we always ask for a good sea story. That's one, but I guess it didn't really involve you. You got any exciting stories from your time in the Harrier? Did you...
Yeah, one of the most exciting, I think, wasn't the kind of good kind of exciting, I guess, but it was... Well, I mean, I had a lot of excitement. I mean, we got, you know, shot at a lot in our war, but just coming back from a 6-hour flight in Iraq, you know, we refueled and we gone like 600 miles north and bottom. And we're coming back to Kuwait, to Al Jaber, Kuwait, in the early part of the war. And the weather forecast, plus or minus an hour, was VFR. So we came back with VFR fuel. Now, bad on me is I didn't double check after 6 hours. Probably should have maybe asked the AWACS to check back, you know, the weather
was. Easy to say now.
Easy to say now, right? Yeah. I can look back and go armchair quarterback it. It was nighttime. It was probably like 3-4 in the morning. And even the approach controller on the radio told us the weather was above. It was not VFR, but it was above the minimums for the TACAN. And they had removed the temporary PAR that they had set up. The Marine Corps had already pulled it out. So we were coming back with a TACAN. Well, it's above minimums. And I have a budding section lead who's doing practice. He's out in front practicing. So I'm really the flight lead, but he's practicing. And he asked what to do. I said, I will take radar trail on you and we'll shoot the approach and land. So I'm a mile behind him on the approach and we're going through and you can't see anything. It's dark. And as we get lower and lower and we're, again, we have VFR fuel. So we don't really have a lot of options. There's Ali Asaleem, which is 30 miles away, but we're in a, they call them a shamal. We're in a sandstorm. And to the point where we had to turn off all of our exterior lights because they were blinding us, you know, from the blinking lights in the sandstorm. The winds started picking up, and Harry, you can see the external winds, and it was really high. And they abandoned the tower because the winds were too high. So the tower, like, was gone.
They left?
They left. So I'm like, this is not good. Yeah. And he's like, what do you do? I said, okay, I now know that Ali Asaleem is the same weather. And this is one of those times where you talk about where, like, well, roads. And I'm thinking, if I eject, you know, I'm going to die probably because, you know, I'm going to hit the ground. The winds are like 70 miles an hour. It's going to drag me to my death and nobody's going to find me and I'm going to hit the ground. You know, it's like jumping out of a car in a freeway.
Right.
So fortunately, with a Harrier, you were able to slow down. Mm-hmm. So I said, slow it down. He's like, I don't see the runway. I said, okay, I know there's no obstructions out here.
It's the desert.
Keep going lower, but, you know, watch your altitude and keep looking for it. And we slowed down to about 60 knots and, you know, an attack end is not the most, it's not a precision approach. Right. So, you know, it's got good GPS. So you're kind of backing it up with that. And then you're flying the attack end direction, but we're now below the min descent altitude on that looking for the runway. We both found it and landed with, you know, no tower. And on the taxi back, it kept getting worse the whole time. And on the taxi back, I couldn't see my wingman at all. I couldn't even see his lights when he turns lights back on because the sandstorm was so bad.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate. And then on the radio, I heard, I called the approach controller and said, yeah, your weather that you reported is not accurate. You can't send anybody here. We had to slow down 60 knots and land. And they told an A-10 flight, hey, did you hear that? They said, yeah, we're going to go to Ali Asaleem because they can't, you know, go 60 knots. Our base actually had me go up back out in the jet after I shut down and taxi out to get better radio reception just on the field and talk to our other flight that was a half hour behind us. And give them direction to land somewhere else, not even come back here. And they went to the tanker. The A-10s did not break out at Ali Asaleem. They all got to the tanker at the same time with the Harriers and the A-10s. And they had a discussion over who was worse off on fuel. I guess the A-10s determined they were because it's a different type of tanking. So they it was a KC-10 that had both types. And then the A-10s did get fuel and went to Bahrain. And then the Harriers, they raised the boom, let the drogue out, and it was sour. So they couldn't get gas and they were almost out of fuel. They jettisoned their Mavericks and their drop tanks. And that's when they were looking at roads in Iraq. And I was passing them all the information because we'd never intended to land there. So here's the frequencies, here's this. That field got hit by lightning right before they were coming in. So it lost all of its electricity. And they used the navigational flare in the Harrier, which is a one-to-one, but to find the runway and just landed on the runway and not talking to anybody because they lost all their power. So that was a rough night. But we got all the Harriers landed, and we all lived. And
there you go. That's a win.
Yeah, that was...
Holy cow. Wow.
That was a scary one.
Yeah, I would say. That sounds a lot like the equivalent of a nasty pitching deck on a night carrier. So, wow, Magua, that's crazy. What did you end up landing with fuel-wise? I mean, was it down to...
I landed with probably, I don't know, like 1,000 pounds. It was not too bad because I had VFR fuel. Mm-hmm. The problem is I really didn't have any fuel to go anywhere else.
Right.
Well, it's not like I could have turned downwind and kept sight of the field either. Right. So I think we got down to maybe 150, 200 feet, which is below attack and mins. But and in the sandstorm, you could see down better than you could see horizontally.
Sure.
So once we got over the field, but you're going 60 knots, you can still make a play for it. And you don't need the entire runway to stop. So even if you break out, you know, halfway down the runway, you can still get it on the ground and stop it.
You have a few more options.
Right.
Okay.
So that was where the Harrier kind of came in and was my friend that day.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, Magua, this has been a lot of fun. And I say this every episode. I'm sure we could go on and on. We barely talked about, for example, the cockpit. Just very quickly, is it old round gauges or do you got some displays?
No, it's got two multi-purpose color displays.
I guess you have to for the radar.
Nice HUD. Yeah, it's pretty
decent.
Pretty good.
Hands-on throttle and stick.
Yeah, it is pretty good. And you'd probably appreciate this in the mission planning side. Mm-hmm. Still, the F-35 didn't even have this. In mission planning, you can go on to the map, which has got a color-moving map in the cockpit. Uh-huh. You can go draw lines. You can type text. You can put all sorts of symbols and displays and SAM rings and whatever you want on this display, and it'll show up on your cockpit when you're flying, which is brilliant. Wow, this is great. It's like, you know, having a drawing program, and you can have it show up in your map. And I don't know why that they haven't done that on newer airplanes.
You just have a data transfer device you carry on your flight suit and then throw it in the jet when you get there.
Yeah, okay. Now it's like a PCMCIA card. That's right. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I learned a lot about the Harrier. I'm sure the listener did too. Really want to thank you for your time today. And I'm jealous that you get to go fly something fun and fast later. Before we let you go, I mean, you've got a good thing going and you're living here in Las Vegas. I mean, what's the future hold? Just keep doing what you're doing?
Yeah. You know, I have enjoyed it. I've been flying A4s primarily for the last 5 years in the L-159. And, you know, it's supporting Air Force Weapons School and also Marine Corps. So I've been doing close air support.
You're still doing CAS.
Still dropping bombs, actually. Wow. Yeah. So for both the Navy and the Marine Corps, which is kind of interesting when you're retired and you press the pickle button. Sometimes I got to pinch myself. I still get to do that. But yeah, it's just fun. And just doing the fighter thing. Going out on the Nellis Ranges and being the bad guy. So now it's all, you know, bad guys that are simulating bad guy type airplanes.
Well, we need to do an episode on companies like Draken. And I know I've spoken with some of your peers over there, Carlos and others. And I think the listener might find it very interesting that there are companies instead of squadrons, frankly, that are out doing what you guys do and actually dropping bombs. I mean, all this is for training.
Absolutely.
But you're dropping bombs. You're acting as bad guys for various players. And dude, I tell you what, if I either lived here or you guys were in San Diego as much as you are here, I think I'd come over and play because that would be a lot of fun.
But yeah, it is.
Cool. So you're doing that and you're going to keep doing it as long as your body will allow? I mean, how's your neck?
I've had some neck, you know, soreness here and there. Like anything, pulling G's, you start to. Yeah, definitely get older, but we have people older than me. I know our average age in our company is, I'm probably on the younger side of the average age. Which is, it's a kind of a geriatric squadron.
50 is the new 30, right?
But that's right. Hey, you know, it's no substitute for experience, I guess. So.
Cool. Excellent. And I forgot to ask you, how many years of service?
27, if you include my enlisted time.
Absolutely,
So 27. Dude,
fantastic. Well, on behalf of the listener, thank you for your 27 years of service. How many flight hours in the military?
That's a good question.
You said about, what'd you say?
Yeah, just over 2,000. Okay. Yeah, just over 2,000. Yeah.
Thank you for that as well. And before we let you go, we have to ask you about how someone, or maybe you, depending on what happened, came up with the call sign Magua.
So when I was in flight school, you know, I was a little more, probably from my grunt days, but high and tight and my big Roman nose here. So it kind of looked like the Last of the Mohicans, you know, the mean Indian with the Mohawk.
Yeah.
And then I kind of further ingrained that just, you know, went to weapons school. So the standards and, you know, being a.
You took things very seriously. Is that what you're trying to say?
I've lightened up over the years, I think. But I got a little bit of reputation. My young captains would call it getting tomahawked, but I just kept the standards high and they all rose to it and did all a great job. So
don't look Native American.
No, I'm not. But
all right.
I don't get my hair cut high and tight anymore either. Don't.
Yeah, there's no need to. I mean, that's a young man's game.
Yes, it is.
Awesome. Magua, this has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your service. Thanks for still supporting the United States military. And unless you got any parting shots, I think we can wrap this up and get out of here.
No, I appreciate it, Joe. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great. Great to be here. And of all the airplanes I flew, I'd like to say the Harrier was still the most fun, just stick and rudder flying. Loved it. Great plane.
Outstanding. All right, buddy. Thanks.
Thanks.
Oh, man, Jello. So listening to Magua there. Absolutely loved a lot of things about the interview, but I didn't realize there is a lot of water. I didn't realize there's about 90 seconds of use out of that. Did you?
No, I'd heard they used water before, but I never understood quite until he explained it, the depth that they have here. And yeah, it seems to me, watching air shows, that they sit there for a lot longer. But of course, when it's that noisy and you're watching it and you're amazed, I suppose time slows down a little bit. But yeah, that's pretty cool. And particularly distilled water, that makes sense. You know, anything that needs water, generally you want to put distilled water in it because otherwise all the minerals and everything else gums up the system. But yeah, that just seems like one extra thing you have to worry about, especially when you go to those forward operating bases like you talked about.
Yeah. That and I thought it was neat. You're right. It was kind of twofold reason for the water, right? So we talked about he talked about the greater RPM, you know, keeping the engine cooler, if you will, but also just the idea of adding mass to the thrust or adding mass to the exit velocity increases the thrust, right? So it was very cool, I thought. Really enjoy that. How about you? Any kind of highlights?
Oh, gosh. The whole thing was fun, and it was kind of a wham-bam trip. I went out in the morning. He picked me up to Vegas from San Diego. We went to a studio there locally, recorded, and then we went and got a bite to eat and dropped me back at the airport. So it was a lot of fun. And I might head back out there because that company, Draken, they've got a bunch of other guys who flew aircraft that we need here on the show. So we might be back.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. But you might notice one thing too, Sunshine. We didn't really cover too much why it looks the way it does. And that's because you and I had covered that previously, I think on what, a deep dive?
We did. You're right, on stability. We talked about anhedral, dihedral, and all that goodness. Did we talk about vortex generators at 1.2, maybe?
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Well, anyway. Potato, potato, whatever.
Well, we're rebranding the whole deep dive anyway here, and you and I are still working on that, so we'll come back around to that. Now, I do want to mention that the DCS players in the audience, Sunshine, will have a special surprise from RazBam, developers of the DCS Harrier module, which is one of the most popular modules because of its amazing attention to detail. They are providing us 3 copies of the Harrier module for us to give away.
Nice.
So if you're a fan of the AV-8B but do not yet have the Harrier module, then you'll definitely want to sign up. Instructions will be in the show notes and also on all of our social media platforms.
Angelo, didn't one of our own team members, right, Baltic Dragon, didn't he have a lot to do with those interactive training missions, especially the Harrier module?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, just today, as we're recording this, we posted an update on our Facebook page about some of the different things that he's done to get us ready for the Harrier episode. And so, yeah, we're going to give away 3 of those, and people can check out his training videos and get good at the AV-8 on their computers.
Very cool.
Okay, on the phone with us today is episode 33 guest Ricky Savage, who joined us last December to explain all about the Wingman Foundation. Ricky, how's it going?
It's going well, Jello. Thanks for having us back on the show.
Sure thing. So I just wanted to give the listeners an update on what you guys have been up to. So what's new at the Wingman Foundation?
So we've been pretty busy in 2019. Fortunately, we haven't had too many mishaps to respond to, so it's been giving us the ability to kind of build out the organization. And from your last show, we were able to recruit some more quality volunteers and subsequently be able to stand up our social media presence, also our comm shop. We've been able to have 2 editions of our Wingman newsletter actually hit the street at this point, what tells the fleet exactly what we're up to. A couple of things I'd like to hit on that we've done so far this year is for our first ever New River, North Carolina Memorial 5K, which we did to memorialize one of our lost Staff Sergeant TJ Dudley, as well as our actual DC Memorial Walk Series. It's the biggest success we've had so far. We not only had the DC Walk Series in Washington, DC, but multiple satellites to include Lemoore and overseas in Iwakuni, Japan, as well as being able to focus a little bit more on our physical memorials, which allows us to stop for a moment and memorialize our fallen. Pensacola Memorial Bell Tower was rededicated earlier this year. That represents all of Marines that are lost in aviation. And 2 months ago, we were able to go to Mount Soledad and remember Head Officer First Class John Clement, who we lost from HSC 85, an aviation ground mishap. So we've been actually been able to focus solely, or not solely, but a lot on our build out, but also turning to what we really like to do and memorialize our fallen.
Outstanding. And you have been busy responding to recent mishaps as well.
Yes. So we've responded to 4 mishaps this year. 2 air mishaps, 2 ground mishaps. The latest was VFA 151. I'd like to stop here and praise some people. I recently started working on project development, and our new mishap coordinator, Lindsay Lampkin, had to deal with 2 mishaps in basically 14 days. HSC 85 had a second class petty officer lost at sea, and then VFA 151 experienced that mishap on July 31st. The mishap team themselves was able to get both of those mishaps surrounded pretty quickly, get in contact with the commands and the families. And it was kind of neat for me because I was able to watch it from the outside and just watch how this organization treats these people. So we are always humbled and honored to do these things, but we were able to get into those things fast, and we know that the families are supported.
Right. And if people want to learn more about the Wingman Foundation, where should they go?
Sure. Our website, wingmanfoundation.org. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. And if you can, please sign up for our newsletter. Every 3 months, we'll put that out and let people know exactly what we're up to and what our upcoming events we intend on putting on will be.
Outstanding. And we're happy to support you here at the Fighter Pilot Podcast as well, Ricky. So thanks for the update on the Wingman Foundation. And we'll catch you again in a few months. Hopefully, you won't have any mishaps to report to us. All right, Sunshine. Well, this is the point in the show where we always want to remind the listeners that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of the hosts and our guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. We want to thank our new Patreon strike lead, Michael Frudman, Mission Commander John Clark, and two air bosses, Robert Miller and George Bravo. And we also want to mention that this show is produced by our friends at the Muscle Car Place Podcast Network. Check out their shows and service offerings at www.themusclecarplace.com. So, Sunshine, any parting shots before we wrap it up and get out of here?
No, I just loved listening to Magwa talk about the Harrier and or the Scarier, as some call it, right? And what do we always say, Jello?
Well, we'll wrap it up and get out of here for today. We'll be back in a couple days to get back on the schedule of the 12th, and then we'll see you for our next feature episode on the 22nd, episode 57. Not quite sure what it'll be yet, but I'm sure it'll be exciting. Until then, we're out of here. See ya.
See ya. You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, brought to you by BVR Productions. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line at 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content, check out our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and subscribe to the show. And don't forget to share us with your network. Thank you for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.